Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. And you?
Good. Do you have any questions before we start?
Not that I could think of.
Okay. Again, same story. If I ask a question you don't want to answer, that's totally fine. It's up to you. And at the end, I'll give you a chance to talk about anything that I didn't ask about that's important to you. So I know yesterday you told me where you were born, but can you tell me again where you were born and then where you grew up?
Sacramento. Also, grew up in Sacramento.
And
Oh, I
other
didn't
things,
question.
go ahead.
So I know we're recording, but you said we're only going to record the audio, and that's what's going to be used.
Yes.
Okay, good. Because I had something in my teeth right now. Just feeling self-conscious about it.
You can stop for a minute, run away, and come
No,
back.
it's good. It's good. I'm okay.
And because I want to be able to focus on your voice and your story, I won't respond like I would in a normal conversation. I'll just wait for you to finish talking and then move to the next question.
Okay.
Okay. So tell me how you're connected to the criminal justice system.
I am connected to the criminal justice system in multiple ways. I myself was directly impacted after I committed my crimes. I was arrested, convicted, and served nearly 20 years while incarcerated. I'm also connected in that I work now to do prison reform, criminal justice reform, sentencing reform. I work with, legislators, district attorneys, bringing survivors of crime, all of them, into prisons and put on events and put them in close proximity, all the stakeholders, and really figure out what's needed for each person, each participant, especially survivors of crime and people who commit harm, really understanding their needs so that for one, people who commit harm don't commit harm, any further harm, and for survivors of crime, what they really need for healing versus the traditional idea of justice, which basically is just vengeance. So we work on that. And what else do I do as far as the criminal justice system? I work with survivors of crime. So in the settings that I just mentioned right now with the district attorneys and the legislators, those are usually surrogate type of encounters for survivors and people who've committed harm. And another thing that I do is actually work with people who've lost loved ones or have been harmed and facilitate dialogues with the actual person that had caused them harm or had killed their loved one. And so those are the ways that I am connected with the criminal justice system.
Okay. How long have you been connected to the criminal justice system? I think you said about 20 years.
Yes, so actually even more, I had other encounters with school police, I think at age 14 and 15. So I'm 42 now. I'm terrible at math, so like 20 something years, over 20 years.
What was your opinion of the criminal justice system prior to your involvement and after your involvement?
My opinion prior was basically F the system. I don't know if this is a family friendly oral history or not, but it was basically F the system, F the police, to hell with all of them. And nowadays, I don't say those words. I don't have like that harsh of a anger towards them. I have more of a defund them. We don't need them. That type of an idea. And it's just based on what I've learned throughout my incarceration as far as what I needed as a child. you know, and resources, and I didn't need policing. I didn't need jail. I needed support. I needed, you know, my needs to be met and to feel whole and seen, which I'd never really got. And the system doesn't do that either. So my feelings are that it needs a radical reform. It needs abolition, maybe. I don't, you know, those things, I don't want to get into that debate. I know there's debates versus on reform versus abolition, but I've been called a radical reformist and I've been called a non-traditional abolitionist. I think there's room for both of those ideas to coexist and bring about great change for our society. So that's how I feel about it. Great change needs to happen for sure.
What is your impression of how the general public thinks and feels about incarcerated people in the U.S.?
My impression is that they don't understand who commits crimes and why. My impression is that they are fed and consume media of incarceration, whether it's news, whether it's movies, that are that highlight only the negativity. Like, after I came home, I actually saw an episode of Lockup and the people that they were interviewing. For me, like, looking back now, I know what's going on with them. Like, I know what's going on in their heads. I've seen these cries for help, these outbursts. I've seen it happen a lot, and I know what's behind it. And for the general public to see it, all they know is that's a criminal. That's an incarcerated person. And they probably wouldn't even say incarcerated person. They would probably just say, that's a convict right there. And that's what they do. And so when it comes to like mass releases that we're trying to get due to the COVID outbreak in California, it's like, no, we don't want 8,000 people. Like, I can actually pick hundreds and hundreds of people that I know. And this is just me. And I know another 100 people that can do the same and pick another few hundred who would be safe for release. And I think there's just a huge misconception about who's in jail, what they're going to do when they come home. There's a huge misconception about violent crime, who commits it and why. And there's a misconception on whether or not they'll be violent forever or violent again. There's just a misconception about violence in general. I just did a podcast recently where a guy was saying that, you know, violence is actually a human nature. It's a natural reaction in just about everybody. Everyone's banged on the table. Everyone's, you know, had an outburst and just, it just varies in degrees. And so when people, you know, look at crimes and horrible violence and tragic violence, I get the fear and the disgust with it. But at the same time, we can't let those fears and just that disgust deter us from looking at the humanity that's on the other end of that. So that's one of the things that bugs me the most about people's misconceptions is violent offenders and the labels that are placed on them. Even offender, I shouldn't even say that. Like, you know, that's just, I'm using the rhetoric of politicians and media, but like that whole category of human beings that are incarcerated are hugely misunderstood.
What was the podcast that you were on?
Transformation stories or stories of transformation. It's not out yet. It's supposed to be out soon, hopefully. Okay. I did a few. I think Amanda Knox, the one I did with Amanda Knox is done. That's out. I forget what hers is called. I mean, if you want to look up stuff, there's like, just Google me. There, I have a lot of stuff all over the place. I even do live streams on Facebook about my parole process and help people bring their loved ones home, or at least help them understand the parole board and preparations and all that. So yeah, if you want to check that out, or if that's necessary part of this.
When did you first learn about COVID and what were your immediate thoughts?
When I first learned of COVID, I can't remember the first moment where, you know, I heard the word COVID or, you know, coronavirus. My initial thoughts were, it's like, it's another flu. You know, it's going to be like H1N1, which I believe I had it. while I was incarcerated. And it was a terrible flu. It was a terrible experience. I didn't know about the respiratory aspect of COVID. I didn't know the deadliness of it. And you know, just based on history in general, you know, there's the bird flu, swine flu, there's SARS, there's all, you know, all these things that come about. And for me, hearing about Corona, I was like, okay, it's just another one of these in the same category. But like I said, I didn't know it was going to be that deadly or that harsh on the world, basically.
And have your opinions changed?
Yes, deeply. As I said, I learned about the respiratory aspect of it. I learned about what happens. I've seen the symptoms. I've seen, you know, so many varying and lasting effects on people, and it's actually frightening. The most, and I keep saying the respiratory part, because that could affect my wife. My wife has asthma, and so instead of like just thinking about it as another flu strain, I actually was like, whoa, let me wipe down everything. Let me make sure I limit my travel and everything. Everything's been limited. We've been sheltering in place. We've took these warnings by CDC to heart and really have been doing our best as a family, and me as the dad of the house, been making sure that we have our supplies and, you know, just being as safe as possible.
What was your initial reaction to COVID-19 in the criminal justice system?
At first, when I first heard about it, actually, as I said, it was, you know, I had that whole progression, that mind change, that shift and the severity of it. And then I thought about it inside. I was like, oh my God, I remember being incarcerated and what it was like to have that bird flu. And I remember what it was like to have, was it norovirus at San Quentin and Legionnaire's disease at San Quentin. And you know, walking by cell after cell and hearing cough after cough. And it's like a sick ward, and it's disgusting. And I thought that this is going to spread like wildfire whenever it gets into a prison. And it made me sad and afraid for the folks that I left behind. And even just for the folks that are trapped in there, and I know what they're facing as far as the hopelessness and the helplessness to get out. You know, my heart went out for them immediately. And so my organization, we did a lot of programs in prison. A lot of our work was done doing those events that I had mentioned. And so we had to cancel all those. We still had the prisons saying, yeah, no, it's good. Come on in. You know, let's have this big gathering of people. Let's run it. And us as an organization, our stance was like, wait, no, that's irresponsible. And, you know, let's stop this for one. And two, let's figure out how we're going to mitigate this if at all possible. And so, you know, our thoughts and our hearts went out to the folks inside, and we have been banging any drum, hitting any and every media outlet that we can to raise awareness, to speak to different coalitions of family members, and we've been talking to legislators. We've been very vocal in what needs to happen. We definitely want to make sure that we do mass releases, we stop transfers, we do all kinds of things to ensure that no more people die. We've already had, I think, 42 in California alone, in California state prisons, die, and it's tragic. Every one of those lives is a human being. And nobody was sentenced to die of COVID. Like that's not in the law books at all, anywhere. It's actually no, it's under the Eighth Amendment, under cruel and unusual punishment. That's the only place that I could think of where you would find any kind of circumstances like this pertaining to the law.
Have you seen COVID-19 change the criminal justice system? And if so, how?
I have seen, so, you know, being home for 3 years, advocating for criminal justice reform, even inside, I've had a lot of support. I've seen a lot of people come in and be supportive of rehabilitation and change within the system. And then I've seen since I've been home, legislation that I've worked on, you know, whether it's, you know, getting voting rights, whether it's ending the felony murder rule, which the organization I work for, we spearheaded that law. We've changed a lot, and we've had a lot of support along the way. But in the last few months, what I've noticed is a huge uptick in community support, in mobilization of family members, in mobilization of members of the legislature, in compassion that, and from them especially too, compassion that has always been there, but not to this level. And a lot of, oftentimes, you know, it's politically safe to, you know, maybe support some criminal justice reform, but not get too heavily invested or put your heart that deeply into it. But I've seen people, you know, really horrified, and legislators come to our press conferences and town hall meetings and really get on stage and say, hey, look, we need to change things. Things are really bad right now. And they might be talking about coronavirus and what's happening now, but at the same time, I feel like those will also have lasting effects on future efforts, you know, as far as getting the realization of who can be released and why do we have such an outbreak right now? Why? And it's because mass incarceration, you know, it existed pre-COVID. And so, you know, that's the one of the, I don't want to say that's the real problem, but it's the root of why this coronavirus has torn so rampantly through California prisons in general because of the overcrowding and the mass incarceration.
What do you want people to know about being incarcerated during a pandemic?
Man, there's a lot to know about being incarcerated during a pandemic. For one, I would say it's impossible to social distance. I have not seen any setting in which it was possible for people to be six feet apart at all times. You know, there's security protocols which require guards to be on you, either cuffing you, escorting you anywhere that you go. The cells are never big enough to socially distance 6 feet. The way that chow and food are distributed, they try to make those protocols, but at the end of the day, they don't have the staff or the resources to implement them in a safe way. I would say that prisons in general are not built for hospice care or for hospital care. They're actually prisons. They're not built for that. And so prisons, I always call them warehouses because, you know, that's what they do. They warehouse people. And how do you make a very profitable warehouse? You cram as much stuff in one space as you can. That's basically what happens. And so they crammed as many people as they can in small spaces. And so that's part of prison. And then as far as what happens during a pandemic, what has been happening that I've seen recently is that, you know, they shut down phones. They, you know, didn't want people to use the phone. They didn't want, you know, they said that it's to mitigate the spread, but I feel like it was to stop the flow of information going out. And so that's one thing that the state had done, especially at San Quentin, is that they shut down phones. Like they really did that. And they, because a lot of people were speaking out about the conditions. There was a lot of public outcry specifically for San Quentin because there's like so many volunteers that go in annually. And so what else goes on in a pandemic? So when it comes to illness, the prison's response is to isolate you. And they isolate you in the same manner in which people go to the hole, solitary confinement. And it's the same conditions, it's the same place. So basically you're punished for being sick. And that's partially, again, because they don't have the resources to stop a pandemic or even deal with major medical issues in general. And so that's one thing to know is that when people get really sick, if you're going to have a surgery, if you have a really, really horrible illness, they will take you to an outside hospital. That's just what happens because, like I said, they don't have the resources. So yeah, so if you do get sick and if it's something that they feel like it's not going to need for you to go to an outside facility, the hole is their solution. And so it's a punitive place and it's not hospitable at all. What else happens in prison during a pandemic? I would say there's a lot of fear and panic just based on what I said about the coughs all throughout the cells, like that's, it's really bad. Like when I had or when I saw the norovirus and the legionnaires, and I seen people coughing and all that stuff, I was like, I guess I'm just gonna get it, right? There's like really nothing that you can do, and so that's really sad and it's scary. And I just wonder about the mental health of folks inside, because you know, here I am, or here, let's just take me for instance, and if I was still inside, I am a person who is going to the parole board. I'm doing a lot of work on myself. I'm trying to get to my humanity and reclaim that. And then your lack of humanity is reinforced by the way that they treat you as a, not even a second class, like a third or fourth class citizen, with no rights, with no compassion. And so that's definitely one of the things that's terrible, and it is not conducive for rehabilitation, for people to reclaim their, you know, humanity. Not that it's gone, but it's just something that the state tries to impart the idea that it's not there. And so they reinforce that with these inhumane and basically mean-spirited tactics. I think that's all I have for what it's like. I would say also too, just the story, like I was punished in the same way as I was just outlining. When I had H1N1, I had shivers. I had the worst flu of my life. I remember thinking that I might die. I was in a cell by myself, fortunately, which is rare. And I remember going to sleep and thinking, I hope I wake up. I really, really hope I wake up. This is really bad. And, you know, there was nothing I could do. I could have went to the nurse and be like, hey, I need some help. And then went to the hole. And then what? Just go to the hole. And there's really nothing they could have really have done. And so I woke up in the morning and I felt better. And then I had just a little bit of a cough left or a sore throat. So I asked for some lozenges during the pill distribution line. And they were like, why? What's wrong? And I said, well, all that's left, I got this little scratchy throat. And they were like, all that's left, what else did you have? And I told them, I said, but I'm good. So you don't got to take me to the hole. And then they took my temperature and they was like, it's a little high. We're taking you to the hole. And so I had to go to the hole and suffering there for a few days with just a scratchy throat. And it was the worst. And it's just another example of one of the many, many ways that the prison is not the place to deal with a pandemic at all in any way, shape, or form.
What do you think the solution is to dealing with COVID in a correctional facility?
What I think the solution is mass release. You know, we have mass incarceration, so we need to do mass release. You know, that's, as I mentioned, that is a huge part of the problem. And so you have all this overcrowding. You have prisons that are, I think, collectively throughout the state, the CDCR is operating at 120% capacity. And so that's ridiculous. People, I think the governor was calling for 100% capacity. And that's also ridiculous, because if you get to that point, then you're basically saying your prisons are full to the gills. And, you know, it doesn't make any room for social distancing in a meaningful way. And so more releases and looking at who's eligible. I mentioned earlier the whole false ideology about violent offenses, and that needs to be looked at. The criteria for the releases need to expand. There's always these exclusions, the nonviolent, you know, non-this, non. And it's like, okay, well, what about the violent offenders? They're ready. When it comes to stats, I think the recidivism rate for lifers like myself is 1 to 2 or 3, between 1 or 3%, and it fluctuates. I don't know how or why, but I've heard different reports. But the highest is 3%. Like 3%, that's crazy, right? Where the average non-lifer, the recidivism, that's a hard word. I don't know why they always have to use that one. But the recidivism rate for non-lifers hovers around 60%. So that's, you know, when you look at stats and data, when it comes to who's safe to be released, it's the lifers. And so lifers need to be considered in these eligibility is there needs to be stopping of transfers is one. That's a no-brainer. You know, the outbreak at San Quentin started because they brought patients from Chino. I don't know if you know about the story. And so they brought people from that prison, which was a hotbed, and there was a huge outbreak going on. And the state actually tried to say that they did their best to screen and make sure the transfers were safe. They were trying to get people out of this situation. But what they did is they tested people, and then they said, okay, well, we're going to wait for your results. And once we get your results and they're negative, we're going to send you back. I mean, we're going to transfer you. So they sent them, they tested them, sent them back to the general population where all the COVID was. And so transfers need to stop. I think a new protocol or procedure needs to be put in place as far as transfers go. Cohorting needs to be utilized when doing testing. So the, and it goes, same goes for the guards. Like if a guard is tested, isolate them. Once it's negative, okay, now you're going with the negatives. If it's positive, then you go with the positives. And so that's one huge thing about cohorting that I feel that the state doesn't understand, or it, maybe they just don't have the capability. So that's why I mean transfers need to stop. What else needs to happen?
What do you mean by cohorting?
So cohorting, like, so when I say cohorting, like, it depends on testing. It depends on transfers. It depends on a lot of factors. So, like, let's say you have an outbreak in one prison, and you want to get the non COVID patients or the patients that are COVID free. You want to get them safely out of there. So, what you would do is you would take them, you would test them, and put them in a safe space, in a clean space, and that would be their cohort. And so once they're cleared and they're good to go, then you can put them on a bus, but that bus would need to be cleaned and you know, COVID-free. The officers that come into contact with them also would need to be in a cohort of their own of officers who are COVID negative, and they need to be isolated and stay away from outbreaks and things like that. So that's what I mean by cohorting. And then just in general, I think the big push, one of the big push when I talk about mass releases, at least one big number that I've heard is reducing the population by 50%. And I've heard about that at San Quentin specifically. There was a report by, I think it was called Amend. They operate out of UCSF, and they did a report, and they were calling for a 50% reduction at San Quentin. And so these huge shifts need to happen because, as I said, these places are operating at 120% capacity. If you drop it to 100, then you're just basically full. If you drop it to 50, now you're in a place where you can possibly have people isolated in their own cells without, you know, a coughing cellmate, and, you know, and have, you know, showers and food distribution done in a safe manner in which, you know, social distancing is possible. So I think those are some of the main things that need to happen.
How has the medical staff within the corrections facilities responded to the pandemic?
How have they responded? I think they responded in the best way that they can. They don't have, as I said, the necessary tools to make the best impacts. They don't. Their hands are tied by safety and security versus hospitality or hospital work. Prisons operate as I said, not just a warehouse, but in a way that puts safety and security, even and not health, in the forefront. And so, like, safety and security only pertains to stopping violence or stopping the possible, you know, drug distribution or whatever happens in prison that is, you know, negative, except for pandemic. So nursing staff, medical staff, they might want to do one thing. They might say, we need to release people. And then the CDC are like, no, that's not going to be good for safety and security of the communities. We don't have protocols to release people. So no, maybe they want to give people hand sanitizer. Like, no, there's alcohol in that. They can drink it. I know that they're doing it now. They are giving hand sanitizer. They are giving masks for the folks inside. But prior to that decision, you know, face coverings were not allowed. One thing that I remember was being in a prison that was in the desert by the border of Mexico, and a sandstorm comes, and, you know, people put their shirts over their face. people had bandanas and they would put the bandana over their face, and the guards would yell at them like, hey, take those off your face. You can't have your face obstructed, because they would say that, you know, if you do that and you and a bunch of people beat somebody up, we can't identify the assailants and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So that safety and security protocol overriding, you know, medical needs, you know, for people to breathe in a sandstorm, like, that's crazy. So, but recently, masks have been deemed okay. But like, those are some ways that there's conflicts between prison staff, prison administration, and medical staff, and their inability to do their job. And I think that they also, I mean, we struggled in the community for PPE, you know, so I can only imagine the shortcomings that they would have as far as having supplies, having the masks, respirators, having the respirators, that would be for the outside hospital, but the gowns, whatever they need, I'm sure, like, they're, and this is like anecdotal, I'm just guessing based on what I remember from medical staff and what they had and what they didn't have. They didn't have much. And so I'm just kind of like saying that I'm guessing that they had a huge lack of supplies.
What are your thoughts on COVID-19 and testing in correctional facilities?
I think it needs to happen. I think testing needs to happen widespread. I think it needs to happen for everyone, for prison staff, for the guards, for the medical staff, there's people that come in to work in the prisons to do like maintenance, to work on maintenance crews, and all of them need to be tested. All of them need to be given whatever test, antibodies, the swabs, all of that regularly, whatever tests can get them the best and most accurate results in the fastest manner. I think that's hugely important for stopping the spread inside.
Can you respond to the media coverage in regard to COVID-19 and correctional facilities? Is there anything that you specifically want to talk about or that hasn't been covered that you wish were talked about?
Well, there's a couple of things. Well, definitely the violent versus nonviolent. I haven't seen any news outlet say, hey, governor or secretary of the CDCR, I see you're releasing 8,000 and you're excluding lifers. You're excluding, you know, people with violent offenses. Here's the data. Here's the recidivism rates. I haven't seen that reported on at all. And it's scary for people to do that. It's like going out on a limb and you know, trying to do the right thing in a world full of wrong. So I haven't seen that. And the other thing that I've seen recently that I don't like is people reporting on crimes, right? Like, let's just say somebody's incarcerated, die of COVID. Why would you say that a convicted murderer on death row has died of COVID? Like, it's a human being. These comments and these titles and labels are meant to sensationalize a story and sell stories. I get that, you know, media is a business, but there needs to be some oversight. I know there is supposedly some, but some in these little more nuanced instances, I feel like that oversight is not being implemented, or at least not even cared about. But I just don't see a need for that. And so I don't like when I see that in, as far as reporting on COVID inside prisons.
Is there anything else you want to add?
Yes. I don't know what this is going to, I forget where this is going and how far the reach is or whatever, but I would say, please stop labeling people. Use person first language, formerly incarcerated person, currently incarcerated people, individuals, not felons, not convicts, not monsters, not crimes. There's people. And they have families. That's the other thing that I would like to see reported, or at least have some understanding about, as far as like, you know, not false claims, but not completely correct comments by the governor talking about, I don't want to release people to homelessness. I don't want to release people to, I don't want to increase poverty or whatever. I have seen so many community-based organizations, and this is something I want folks to know, is that there are, I don't know how many community-based organizations moving right now, mobilizing to ensure safe reentry, to ensure possible quarantines for people upon release. Like, they're coordinating this statewide. And I have personally tweeted this fact out. And people have responded and saying like, hey, no, I'll go pick up my son. I'll pick up my husband right now. I'll take his cellie too, you know, his cellmate. I've seen a huge outpouring of support for people for more releases and for safe releases. So I definitely would like to see more reporting on that, or at least, you know, mention it here and get the word out that way.
Okay. If you can hang on for just a minute, I'm going to stop the recording. Mm-hmm.